Good afternoon. Wilkinson here. I am back home in Palm Springs after a lovely vacation in Massachusetts for a couple of weeks visiting my son and his family. And I'm starting up on my podcast again. And my guest today is Alan Fraser. Say hi, Alan.
Hi there, everybody.
So who's Alan? We all want to know that. Let's ask a couple of questions. So tell me a little bit about where you grew up and your life before Palm Springs. You can kind of fill in any gaps you want there.
Sure. I was born and raised in Amesbury, Massachusetts, which is a small town north of Boston. And I lived in New England. I went to college there in Rhode Island. I lived in Rhode Island for 10 years after I got out of college in Providence. And then I made a big move to Florida in my late 20s. I started my career as an architect in Tampa, Florida. And I practiced there and lived there for, I think, 30 years, maybe 32. The last couple of years before moving to Palm Springs, I lived in Orlando, Florida with my current husband. We made a big move out here to Palm Springs area in 2020 during COVID and built a home, and we're real happy here. It was kind of our forever home we had decided we were going to build.
Had you visited Palm Springs before?
Yeah, we had vacationed here a number of times. We had looked at places that we wanted to move to long term. One of the places at the top of our list actually was Santa Fe, New Mexico. We had traveled there many times and we fell in love with it. After I became a double amputee and got prosthetic legs, I started thinking Santa Fe is like a 7,000 foot elevation. They have harsh winters there. Maybe we should go spend a winter vacation there and see how I do, which we did. We went there for Christmas and New Year's about a year after I got my prosthetic legs. I'm an amputee. We haven't talked about that. Sorry, I kind of jumped ahead. We decided it really wasn't going to be a good place for me in the winters. So our second place on our list was Palm Springs. So we started spending our vacations here and we fell in love with it. And we decided that this was where we wanted to be.
Okay. And on architecture, were you residential, commercial? What did you do?
Primarily commercial. My education was as a classic architect. I was a graduate architect. I practiced a lot in interior commercial architecture through most of my career. I just kind of fell into that, and it became kind of a niche business in the Tampa area because Tampa was a growing, booming medium-sized city when I moved there in the 80s. And so there was a lot of office buildings, a lot of high-rise construction. A lot of it was in that. In 2002, I went out and practiced on my own with another gentleman. We started our own business. And at that point, we started doing a lot of residential work as well as commercial. We did a lot of large multimillion-dollar homes in the Tampa area. And that was fun because it was kind of like...
Did you like that better than the commercial stuff?
Or? I wouldn't say better. It was nice that it kind of balanced things out. The commercial work can, after 20-plus years of it, is a little bit of boredom in it where it becomes sort of a lot of the same.
Right.
Trying to be creative in an industry where you have a lot of limitations on you. The residential kind of like opened things up and it kind of balanced out the commercial end of it for me. I wouldn't say I liked it better. There was a lot more babysitting and psychological work that had to be done with clients in the residential business than there is in commercial. So that can be exhausting. So,
and lots of change orders.
All the time. Yeah. All a lot of second guessing. Clients always second guessing what you're doing and you're always trying to convince them that we're going down the right path and just stay calm and it's all going to look beautiful in the end.
So you've let a couple cats out of the bag, but that's
yeah, okay. Sorry about that.
So no, it's fine. So the first thing is though, you said you have a husband, which then means you're gay. So talk about that. When did you discover you're gay?
Oh, good Lord. I think I always knew. From as far back as I can think.
Did you have a word for that when you were younger?
I did not. I had no idea what it was. I just knew I was different than all the other boys. I knew I was looking at things I probably wasn't supposed to be looking at and was made to feel ashamed for. So it wasn't until I was about halfway through college that I really came to terms with it. Probably I was maybe 20, 21. Okay. And that's when I actually came out to my close circle of friends and actually dealt with it. And started living my life, not completely out, but more in a sense, more out than I had been prior to that. I was totally closeted up till that point. So,
and did you come out to your family then or no?
I never really officially came out to my family. My family just sort of figured it out through osmosis over time.
You sure been with that roommate a long time, huh?
Relationship was with an older gentleman and we were together 8 years and we were the classic roommates, you know, that whole time. My right. sisters later told me that they always knew. And my mother even kind of told me that years later, probably I was probably in my 40s before she and I had that conversation. And she said, you know, I always knew you were different. And it was always okay with me. You know, your father and I just wanted you to be happy and to live a happy life and do the things you wanted to do. So
you had a gay conversation with her at some point.
I did. My second partner passed away of AIDS in 1993. And I felt compelled to actually sit down with my mother at that time and explain to her what was going on and had gone on. I was going through major grief for the first time in my life when that right. happened. And I wanted her to understand like what had happened to me. And so that's when we had, I guess, the conversation. Yeah. Although I never just came out and said, "Hey mom, I'm gay." but she knew. You know, she knew that I loved him and that this was like a life-changing experience for me that I had just been through. So, I feel fortunate that I had parents that didn't really pressure me one way or the other. They really just kind of let me find my own path in life. And maybe that's because we were New Englanders and we all kind of have a steely exterior and we kind of look the other way and try not to get in too much in other people's business. But that kind of worked out for me in that I was able to kind of find my own path.
And what about your father? How did he take it?
My father and I had a little bit of a disconnected relationship most of my life. He and I feel like we reconciled it at the very end. He died of colon cancer when he was 82. I was one of his primary caregivers at the end. I basically moved my office. I still had a business at the time. I moved my office into the den in my parents' home.
Wow.
For several months, and I basically became his caregiver. And he and I had a lot of conversations at the end of his life, those last few months, that I think brought us together. It resolved a lot of things for me, and I know that he loved me, and he went out of this world. And I was able to tell him I loved him before he died. So
that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. All right. Second cat. So I'm looking at your legs here. Talk about that.
My fancy legs.
Your fancy legs. They're shiny.
I wear two prosthetic legs. I am a bilateral, to be medically correct, a bilateral below knee amputee, which means I have I had both of my lower legs amputated mid-calf for me. And so I wear that happened in 2015. And since 2016, I've had prosthetic legs. I have learned to walk again and pretty much do, I want to say, about 90 to 95% of everything I could do before I lost my legs. Hmm. So, yeah. And they're really cool legs. They're kind of state-of-the-art equipment for what you can get nowadays. They're not athletic legs that you see some of the Olympic athletes running, you know, races with.
That springy thing.
Yeah. And I have people ask me all the time, why don't you have those great big springs like we see the runners with? I'm like, because I'm not an Olympic athlete and I don't need those to like walk around and do my grocery shopping.
So I didn't actually that I was ignorant on that. So the springy looking thing, and I'm sure we've all seen them on that.
Yeah.
On watching TV. But so that really it's for athletic.
It's strictly for running. I mean, those athletes don't even wear those all the time. They only wear them for the specific sports that they're competing in and practicing for. So they would take them off and put on something probably more similar to what I'm wearing here, which is like a normal sized foot. And I actually have inside my shoe is a rubber foot, and inside the rubber foot is a small version of that big spring that everybody kind of can visualize that they've seen.
Oh, it's within the rubber part?
It's within the rubber part. So I have like a miniature spring. It's about the size of a normal foot. I have a size 9.5 shoe, and it fits in there. And that actually gives me a spring to my step, so to speak. It gives me a lot of mobility.
And I'm looking at it. It looks like there's like a cable going down there. Are they electronic in some way?
They're not electronic. They're actually pneumatic.
Okay.
What I have is if you picture putting on a prosthetic leg, and most people probably never have pictured it unless they're an amputee. But the leg has to be held on somehow so it doesn't fall off. It can't, you know, when you first get prosthetic legs, my very first set, I call them my training legs. They're really just held on by friction. I mean, you put them on, you pull up a sleeve that goes over, you know, your human part of your leg that's still there. And then you just hope it doesn't fall off. And you walk around in those things all day. And if you live in a hot environment like I did in Florida, you become, you perspire a lot and you become sweaty, and those things can literally slide off of you. So fortunately, those aren't your permanent legs. I only had to wear those for about 6 months until I got a set of legs that actually had a real system for keeping them on my body. And the system I'm in now that you're asking about is a pneumatic system. And what it is it's almost, if you can picture shrink wrapping like a product or a box.
Okay.
I put on my legs, I pull up a sleeve over it. And then as I walk, my little spring-loaded feet that I was talking about have a pump in them. And every step I take pumps that little pump in the heel of my foot. And that pump is suctioning air out of my prosthetic socket. My prosthetic socket is made of carbon fiber material. So it's a very hard plastic. And inside of that is my residual limb, which is covered in a protective sleeve to protect my skin. And outside of that, a hard plastic socket is a sleeve. And that sleeve is there to create an airtight environment. And then as we're suctioning air out of my prosthetic, it literally shrink wraps it onto my leg. And it stays there pretty firm unless I do like really strenuous activity in the gym. I do aerobics a few days a week when I can, when my legs are healthy enough for it. And I get pretty sweaty doing that. And the legs can get a little bit loose and I lose some suction, but I can take them off, dry my legs and reset them and get back to it. And I have a really good system. But the nice thing is that I can do high kicks. I can do, you know, I can really do high activity in these and I don't have to worry about my legs falling off, which is kind of a horrible problem for someone to have.
Problematic.
I actually had my leg fall off in the grocery store when I first had prosthetics. It got my foot got caught under the wheel of the cart, and I was so sweaty from having, you know, I was a new amputee, and I had my training legs on, and I'm trying to go about my business, you know, like live my life and do my grocery shopping. And my foot gets caught under the shopping cart wheel, and it pulls the leg right off of me in the store, and down I go.
Oh no!
It was definitely a learning. It was a learning experience for me.
People are looking at you.
Oh, for sure. Fortunately, there's always some good people in the crowd, and some people came over and offered me help and said, "Oh, let us help you up." And I'm like, "Well, I got to put my leg back on first, so if you can just hold on a minute."
Oh my gosh!
So
wow!
And that wasn't the only time my legs fell off, but that was probably the most embarrassing story I can tell when it did.
Wow. What's been one of the big challenges? Talk about the process. First of all, I guess I'm getting ahead of the game. So talk a little bit about how you came to have your legs being amputated in the first place. Because we chatted a little before this, but not on the podcast.
Yet. Right. Well, when I lost my legs, I was a 55-year-old man. This was in 2015, and I was probably the healthiest and most fit in my whole life at that point. I had worked really hard. Going into my 50s, I had made a pact with myself that I was going to get in shape, get healthy. I didn't want to go into like the last third of my life having health issues. So I had done a lot of gym training, weightlifting. I had taken up cycling. I was like super fit. So out of the blue, I got really sick one day. I had to actually come home from training at the gym with my trainer one evening, and I just felt like sick as a dog, like worse than I ever could remember feeling. And I remember laying on the couch that night and thinking, boy, what's going on? I've really overdone it or something. 24 hours later, my husband, we weren't married at the time, he was my partner, found me unconscious with 105 fever on my bed the next day in my house, sick as a dog. And I ended up in the hospital emergency room that night. Come to find out, I had, after they did a number of tests on me, they found out that I had bacterial meningitis and septicemia, otherwise known as meningococcal septicemia, which is like having two deathly diseases at the same time. A large percentage of people that get meningitis die, especially the bacterial form that I had. And a large percentage of people that get sepsis don't make it through. I was so sick and it had advanced so quickly and so far with me that I basically crashed in the hospital that night and they put me on life support. They restarted my heart with the paddles. They put me on dialysis. My liver was failing. They basically had to put me in what they call a medically induced coma just to kind of keep me alive and to try to save my life. So for the next 14 days, I was in this coma I didn't know where I was. I wasn't conscious of any of it, but my partner was there through the whole thing and fortunately was the one that saved my life and got me to the hospital. So the outcome of all that after 14 days in a coma was that my feet were gangrene, because the process of saving your life at that point, when you have what I had, is they have to lower your blood pressure down very, very far. And they have you hooked up to all these machines on life support. And pretty much the circulation to your extremities just kind of goes away and it stops. And so if you can picture your feet not having any blood circulating to them, even for like a few hours, let alone 24 or 48 hours, my feet were not salvageable. So when I came out of the coma 14 days later and lived through it, one of the first questions they asked me, we need to take your feet. We need to amputate them. And, you know, we need your permission. So I had been a registered nurse for a very short time in my life early on. Mm-hmm. It was actually in the middle of my architectural career. So I kind of knew the situation. It was shocking as it was. They showed me my feet. I saw the coloration of them. And I was like, you know, you do what you got to do, you know. So that's how I lost my feet.
Wow.
Then the rest of the story was the recovery process. But that was what got me to the amputation stage. It was a life-changing experience, you know, in a huge way. You know, it changed my whole direction in life, everything that's happened since, and really changed my outlook and attitude about life in a big way. So mm-hmm. It's as horrific as a story it is to recount and tell to people, there was a lot of positive that came out of it too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to kind of turn lemons into lemonade, but you know, you have to take bad situations that happen to you in life. You have to roll with them and figure out how you're going to move on from them. And I think I've worked really hard at making that, my job.
Right. I imagine when you came home from the hospital with no legs, being a new experience. So was the first 6 months, the first year, what was the most difficult?
Well, there was several months in the hospital after the amputations. I was in the hospital for another 2.5 months after that. Okay. I was in a convalescent home for a good 5 to 6 weeks, which was like horrendous. I hope nobody has to go to those places. It's the places where they put elderly people that are terminal, and they didn't really know what to do with me, but they had to put me somewhere where I could begin the healing process before I could go to rehab. Once I got out of that place, I went to a nice inpatient rehab hospital in Tampa, which is like one of the best in the country, fortunately for me. And I spent about 2.5-3 weeks in there, where they teach you how to take care of yourself, once you get home, like how are you going to function, how to get in and out of the car, how to get on and off the toilet, how to move around in a wheelchair, how to just transfer myself and do my bandage changes and all the stuff I was going to need to do for myself once I got home.
So you didn't have the prosthetics at that point?
No, I didn't get the prosthetics for almost exactly a year. Okay. It was almost a year to the day after my amputations.
Because your legs probably have to heal, right?
My legs have to heal. A lot of people that get amputations, they can get their prosthetics quicker because they have amputations for different health reasons. If you have clean tissue that the doctor is surgically removing above the amputated area,
right,
the healing process can take just a few months, and you can probably get into prosthetics in, you know, 3, 4, 5 months down the road. With me, since I had the meningitis and the sepsis, I had caused a lot of necrosis, and I had dead necrotic. I know this probably sounds really horrific to people listening, but I had dead necrotic tissue all over my legs, all over my arms, on my face, all over a lot of my body. And that happened from the illness syndrome that I had. Because of that, the surgeon, and I had a great surgeon, and he did a great job with my amputations, he had to kind of magically figure out how he was going to remove the gangrenous feet. And still, but he had to cut through tissue that wasn't super healthy tissue. I had a lot of necrotic tissue that he was cutting through and having to sew back together. So when he stitched my residual limbs together, about 50% of the skin that he used was necrotic tissue that was stitched together with healthy tissue. There was also skin grafts that he had to work in there from other places. And so it was kind of like a patchwork quilt. So because of that, it took a really, really long time for my legs to heal. It took almost a whole year. And it was
Did you have subsequent surgeries for some of the...
Fortunately, I didn't have to.
Okay.
There was a chance that I might have to if things didn't really come together. They gave me some options when I when I got out of rehab, they said that I could have hyperbaric treatments, which would accelerate the healing process for someone like me, or I could go home and go through the normal healing process. And I opted for the normal healing process, and I'll tell you why. The hyperbaric chamber thing meant I had to sign a contract with the provider, and I had to be in the hyperbaric chamber 6 days a week for 7 to 8 hours.
What?
I couldn't bring a book or a newspaper, anything inside the chamber with me, because that type of treatment is it's a high oxygen environment and it's explosive. So you can't bring any kind of combustible material in the, and oh, I thought, wow. How am I going to get back in my head, get back where I need to be mentally if I'm literally laying in a hyperbaric chamber every day, staring at the ceiling through a glass window with nothing to do. So I just said, you know, to me, it wasn't worth like accelerating the process by a few months. And so I just stuck it out and I did I healed when I healed, and it took a year. So, yeah. So I learned patience that year. I learned how to be a patient man. I would go to the surgeon about every week or every other week, and he'd check my my process, and he'd say, well, we're making progress, but we're not there yet. And I'm like, please, please, please tell me I can get my prosthetics started. Because you want to get back on your feet. You kind of want to get your life back together. And that really, living in a wheelchair for that whole year, it really just delayed the process of kind of getting my life back together. Right.
So what are some of the biggest things you learned?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. Right. Biggest things I learned.
Chop it into
people. I learned that family and friends are a crucial part of not just of life, but in a crisis situation like I was in. I really do think my husband and my family and friends that visited me throughout my coma and after that, when I was in rehab and all those hospital months, really helped. I don't even know how to put this. It was important that they were there.
Right.
And it really kind of accelerated my mental well-being as far as having people remind me, you know, Alan, you've always been an overachiever. You know, you're going to ace this. You're going to get back on your feet once you get your legs, and you're always good at anything you try, and you're going to be okay at this. And having those people there to kind of cheer me on and remind me that I was going to get through it was a huge help.
So when you were in your coma, did you have any awareness of anything, people or anything?
I didn't. My husband was sort of like the sentry. He only let people in my room. I guess they would only allow, since I was in like a high level intensive care, they'd only let one or two people in my room at a time for very short periods. But he screened everybody that came to the hospital, and he made sure that they weren't going to say anything negative in my presence, that they weren't going to talk about, they weren't going to show make horrific sounds like, oh my God, look at him. He was very much, he was a believer that I was, whether or not I was, that he believed that I was aware of everything that was going to be going on around me. And he tried to keep a totally positive environment in my room. Who knows? That may have made the difference. As far as my awareness, I didn't have any. I remember when I look back on it and when I came out of it, I do remember having things that felt like dream states. And they were always either like really ugly dreams or really pleasant ones. And I can remember having dreams of being trapped in like a basement of a factory and having like these loud banging noises and just really like things that were like hurting my head. The flip side of that was I had dreams that I was like on a porch in the South Pacific with hibiscus flowers blooming all around me and listening to tropical music. Those are pretty much the only two vivid memories I have of my time.
And is that from like when you were coming out of it? Is that when that took place?
I don't know. I've been told that I was taken down for MRIs on a regular basis, because when you have what I had, they're always checking you to make sure you don't have brain damage.
So that could be that banging
noise. That could have been the banging noises when they were putting me in that chamber. I don't know. And then I was also told that my husband told me that he used to put like in the TV in my room, he would put this pleasant music and stuff on the TV, like the music channel that played like soft, like massagey music while when he was in the room with me. So that might have been the pleasant experiences I had. But other than that, that's pretty much it. You're like out. You have no awareness of much of anything. And when you come to, it's shocking. Because I didn't know where I was. because I was on dialysis and all these machines, I was swollen up kind of like the Michelin tire man when they brought me out of the coma. So I couldn't move. My body was huge and swollen, so I could just barely move in bed. And I couldn't talk because I'd had a breathing. I'd been on a ventilator for 2 weeks. Right. So once they pull that tube out of your throat, it takes you several days before you can really talk again. Your throat is so damaged from it. So I couldn't really communicate. And my eyes were kind of swollen shut. And there's doctors all around and everybody's
kind of... You were a mess.
I was a mess. And people are like staring at me. I mean, I'm looking up and there's all these people looking down at me like in shock. Like they can't believe that I'm awake and I'm alive. So...
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, good thing you did that, that you are alive.
Oh, I'm a very grateful man. Trust me. I look in the mirror every day and I remind myself what a lucky man I am. You know, I lost some parts of my body, but I'm here. I'm alive. I'm moving on with life and, I'm very grateful for it. And I see life in a kind of a whole new light. You know, I have so much more appreciation for it. I was a total type A before this happened to me. You know, I worked 7 days a week. I had my own small architectural business. So you don't have a staff to rely on. So I was kind of it, me and my business partner.
Well, besides, you can do it better yourself, right?
Well,
that's me.
you don't even know me well enough to say that.
No, but it's probably true. I know the type because that's how I was.
Now I just take my time.
Right.
You know, it's like there's no urgency. I mean, there is for certain things, obviously. But for the most part, why rush everything? Because you're not here for that long. And I kind of learned like how fleeting life is. And it's sort of like, you even enjoy the bad stuff, like, you know, bad traffic or that bad meal in the restaurant. Try to figure out how to still enjoy it and have a good time. And it's all good.
So we talked a little before we started the podcast about people's reactions, and talk about that a little bit. What's been the process on that?
As far as strangers' reactions?
Yeah, I mean, strangers, yeah. And anyone. I mean,
yeah.
We talked a little about it, but.
Yeah, one of the things that it took me a while to wrap my head around was just having to, there's a lot of curiosity out there about amputees. There's not a lot of us circulating out in public. I think more and more people are out. I think people have better equipment and gear, and there's a lot more there's a lot more opportunity for amputees to be out and be about. But for the most part, the general public hasn't really seen us. We're kind of like invisible and they don't really know about us. So I have people come up to me everywhere, at the supermarket, at the bank, in a parking lot, at the gym. First, they usually want to like congratulate me. Oh, you're doing so well. It's so good to see someone like you up and about. There's always questions. And sometimes it just starts with a question like, you know, what happened to your legs? Or, you know, how do you walk in those things? And so when I first was a new amputee, these sort of questions just threw me and it kind of made me really uncomfortable. I shied away from it. I kind of felt like it was intrusive. And I think looking back, I hadn't yet wrapped my head around being an amputee yet. It was so new to me and I was still so uncomfortable in my own skin and so unsure of myself that just having strangers come up and want to kind of pry into my personal business to me was, I found it offensive and I could be short with people. I would answer people in very simplistic one or two word answers just to try to dismiss them. Sometimes I'd be sarcastic with people, which isn't good. But over time, I became more comfortable with it. I really see that answering questions is really a good thing for me and for the other person because people don't know. And I think the more information people have by allowing them to ask questions and just being comfortable answering them, I think can kind of broaden people's awareness of what amputees go through. It kind of makes amputees kind of more of a regular event in someone's life. We're not just this weird anomaly out there. So I've kind of come full circle and I'm pretty open to people asking me pretty much anything and I'm happy to talk about it. I spent probably 25 minutes at the doorway to Trader Joe's last week talking to a woman who stopped me. I was on my way into the store and she was on her way out with a cart and she literally like pushed her cart in front of me to stop me. Said, I really, really need to talk to you.
And why did she want to talk to you?
She'd come to find out that her best friend from high school, who was actually like a childhood friend that she went all through school with, she reconnected recently with like a few years ago at a high school reunion and they started becoming chums again after like 40 or 50 years not seeing each other. And he wrote to her 2 months ago and told her that he had to have his leg amputated. So he's a new amputee, and he's just getting a prosthetic leg. She wants to invite him to come. He lives alone and doesn't really have anybody. So she wanted to invite him here to the desert to spend a few months with her.
To spend some time with both of you?
Well, I don't know about that.
So you could
I don't know her that well. She was a total stranger.
Right.
But no, but it was a really valid reason to ask me questions, and I felt compelled to give her as much information as I could. She really wanted to help her friend. And she was like, you know, is it the right time? You know, maybe it's too soon for me to invite him here. You know, maybe, you know. And so we talked quite a bit about it. And she was so grateful. And she went on her way and she said, I learned so much from you. It's just, I just so appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And that makes me feel like, you know, maybe there's a purpose to all of this.
Right.
You know, who knows?
And I imagine sometimes people are jerks about it.
I've had a few.
Is that a small percentage?
It's a pretty small percentage, yeah. But I've had some pretty outrageous things happen to me. I had a woman come into a Starbucks once when I was just kind of sitting. It was a crowded Starbucks around lunchtime. This was back when I was still living in Florida. I was just kind of minding my own business, having my Americano in the corner and reading either a book or a magazine. I can't remember. Sort of out of the corner of my eye, I see someone come in the door and stop. And you know when you can sort of tell someone's looking your way,
right,
even though you're not really looking right back at them? It's like,
right,
I think that person in
you
the corner
see the
of my
eyes.
Eye. Yeah. So yeah. I start to turn. And before I can even turn all the way, she says, what the heck happened to your legs? What happened to you?
She's shouting this across a crowded Starbucks.
She's probably a good 20 plus feet away from me. And everybody, of course, stops what they're doing, even as noisy as a Starbucks can be with the music and all the hubbub. The place like seemed like it went silent and everybody's got their eyes on me and her. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? I couldn't believe that she would do this. So I think I shouted something to the effect back, like, you know, I'm not really prepared to talk about my personal business in a crowded restaurant or something like that, thinking that she would just go away, you know, that she would take that as like being dismissed and that would be the end of it. It was not the end of it. She kept shouting stuff across the restaurant.
And none of the other people said, shut up, Karen, to her, which
actually,
I probably would have.
Actually, nobody did. She did finally back off. She went and ordered a drink. I had my eye on her. And then as she was leaving with her drink, she opened the door as she's stepping out the door. She shouted something like, well, I was just trying to find out about you and get to know you or something like that. And off she went. The nice thing was, even though nobody really intervened, a lot of people came up to me after that and apologized on her behalf and just said, that was just so, you know, I'm just so sorry that happened to you. But people are generally really nice about it. And the people like that, that just do shockingly inappropriate things, they're few and far between.
Bizarre.
But that's probably the most outrageous experience I had in a public place anyway with someone.
Well, the moral of the story on that is don't go to Starbucks.
I wish.
Yeah. How about kids? How do they approach you?
Kids are super curious, and I love to talk to kids about it. I actually have a great nephew who's, I think he turned 7 this year, or maybe he might be turning 8. But when he was 5, he was just so full of questions, you know. And this is actually kind of a funny story. I was visiting my sister, and it's her grandson. And he was staying over. When I go away on a trip, I bring like all my gear with me. I have like extra gear, like prosthetic gear I'm talking
right.
about. Extra liners, extra pieces of equipment, you know, as backup and to change into. I had all my gear in the bathroom because I was staying at her place. And my little great nephew went in the bathroom and he came out and he ran to my sister and he said, Grammy, what's all that stuff in the bathroom? And she said, oh, those are Uncle Alan's spare legs. And, or something to that effect.
Had he met you at that
point? Oh, yeah. He'd actually, for a couple of years, he had already been familiar with me having prosthetic legs, but he'd only seen me like walking around in them. So he kind of views me as sort of like a robot man, like a transformer with like these mechanical parts. And he became comfortable with that. Well, all of a sudden his eyes got really big and he's like, you mean Uncle Alan's legs come off? He can put on other legs. And it was like a whole new world opened up to him because now he's realizing that my legs aren't like permanently part of me. They're actually something that goes on and off like spare parts.
So he thought you came that way with
I'm not really sure. I mean, it's hard to get inside the head of, like, he was probably four or whatever the first time he saw me in prosthetics. But it was really so cute. He pulled up a chair on the screen porch, dragged it right over right next to me, sat down next to me, says, I have a lot of questions for you, Uncle Alan. And he proceeded for the next hour or two to, like, asked me like anything that would come to his mind about my legs. He wanted me to take them off, put them back on. He wanted to see what my residual legs looked like without the prosthetic on there. And like, it was hilarious. So, I just love experiences like that. But I find that in public, kids will look and they'll look again and they'll look like three times and they'll want to come over and ask something. And by the time they've looked the third time, the parents are usually yanking them by the arm and pulling them away and saying, no, leave that man alone. You know, don't talk to him. And I've actually gone up to parents and said, you know, it's really okay. They can ask me, you know, your son or daughter can ask me whatever they want. I want kids to be comfortable seeing people like me out in public, comfortable knowing that it's okay that somebody has, you know, limb difference, some other kind of prosthetics. That's the age that they should be getting familiar with this kind of stuff so that they're not clueless and they don't think of it as just a freakish, weird thing when they see it. So,
So looking back through this whole experience, there's a podcaster I listened to, and he was in a horrific car accident. He was going like 60, 70 miles an hour and blacked out and hit a guardrail. And his Tesla it didn't even look like a car, but the part of the guardrail just went across his lips and cut up toward his eye, just cut his face open. But he talked about, he's a really cool podcaster. It's Aubrey Marcus, if anybody's listening and they want to check him out. And Tony Robbins says a similar thing, but he said one of the things he realized was that this happened for him and not to him. Does any of that ring a bell with you? I mean, look at what's happened and maybe the trajectory that you were on. How would your life have gone had this not happened? Did it reap more benefits than the negative? Or how do you feel about all that? And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth saying, no, I'm glad this happened. But what do you think about all that?
No, I think that's I totally think that a lot of good has come out of it. You know, I think a lot of good comes out of a lot of horrific things. If you figure out how to adapt to the changes that have happened to you. I think had I not been willing to move forward and change and adapt to my new life, I don't know what the outcome would have been. I think it would have been a dark one and I would be in a whole different place today. But yeah, my life has changed in really nice ways. I've gotten married. I've moved to California. I've built my forever home with my partner. I retired from a business that was literally probably taking years off my life. As much as I loved what I did and what my career was, I did it for 35 years. I had a good run of it. It was time for me to move on. And I would probably still be toiling away, running from client to client meetings, getting more and more bald and gray in the beard. So having a horrific life-changing crisis happen to you, yeah, it's horrible in the short term, and it's even more horrible for the people around you. In my case, I tell people, you know, I slept through most of what happened to me. It was my husband and my family that were there and had to watch me go through that and not know day to day to day whether I was going to live or die. They're the ones that really had the traumatic experience and still probably have some PTSD over living through that. I don't. I was able to like sleep through it. Wake up, make a decision that I was going to, you know, the day I agreed to have my amputations, I decided, you know, I got to wrap my head around this and I got to figure out how I'm going to move on with my life. And I told the doctors, I said, I want you to bring in anybody you can that's going to show me like what my life as a prosthetic wearer is going to be. I want to see what prosthetics look like, how people wear them, how their life is affected. I wanted to know anything I could know. And that's just kind of how I've always approached everything in my life anyway. I'm a planner and, you know, I was an architect for heaven's sakes. It's another word for a planner. And I started right from day one, like planning like my recovery and like the steps I was going to have to go through. It didn't go as quick and as smooth as I thought it would. Things never do. But on the far side, looking back now, I really see all the ways it's made me a better person, a more compassionate person, a more patient person, a more understanding person, a more appreciative person. I have so much gratitude for this life I have, much more so than I probably ever did prior to this happening to me. I probably never really stopped to think about things like that.
Right.
And now I do. When I have a bad day, and I have plenty, it's, you know, wearing prosthetic legs is no breeze. It's not a piece of cake. I have good days and bad days. Some days I put them on and they feel great. And I'm like, wow, I'm going to have a good day. And I'm ready to go to the gym and zoom through my day. Other days I put them on and it feels like literally somebody's crunching my body in a vise and it's all pain. And it's those days that I have to really remind myself, look in the mirror and remind myself of what I have and how grateful I am to be alive. And, you know, this may be a little bit of pain and I have to push through it today, but it's all going to be worth it. I wasn't the kind of person that thought in those terms right before, you know, so it's really brought me to a new place, to a higher understanding, I think, of who I am as a person and what it all is. I don't really know what's in store for me down the road. I kind of feel like, and I've had people tell me as well that, you know, there's probably a role for me as a person in prosthetics, you know, to do something with it right and to make other people's lives better or to enrich right people's understanding of things. And it would be nice. I don't really know what that path is and where it right leads and how I get on it. But, you know, it would make it all even that much more worth having happened to me if right something really cool came out of it.
Well, I think just being on here is another piece. I mean, I'm certainly learning a lot. I have learned a lot. And so I'm sure the listeners will yeah too. Do you have any final words you want to say to everybody? That was great what you just said, and that's kind of put it in a nutshell. But is there anything else you'd like to add? Or
trying to think. Just that, you know, I think bad things are just kind of a part of everybody's life. We all have bad stuff that happens to us. I mean, people get horrible illnesses, chronic illnesses. People have accidents. People have health crisis like I have. And I just kind of think it's, you can't just focus on that. You have to focus on your energy outside of that mm-hmm and know that there's a bigger picture here and that you're just, what happened to you is just a small part of the picture.
Right.
And you're going to get through it. If you can be willing to open yourself up to adapting to change. I think human nature is people don't like change. In my case, change was thrust upon me. I mean, I had a lot of changes in a very short time, in a matter of months. And right it was just sort of like my body changed, my career changed, everything changed. It's all about being open to just letting that change in and letting it change you and adapting to it. If you're willing to do that, good things will come out of something bad. So I'm not trying to be too profound here, but that I really mean it.
Right.
So,
well, it was great having you today. Thanks. Appreciate you coming in.
I appreciate the offer to have this chat.
And you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. Bye now.